Is your appetite sometimes out of control? Are you unable to stop eating even when you're full? Download our new Intelligent Medicine video, Defensive Eating, Taming Your Addiction to Food. There's a physiological basis for food addiction. The food industry has gripped our brains using powerful food science. Find out what we can do about it. Go to drhoffman.com to download this important video. We will arm you with proven strategies to change your eating behavior forever. Go to drhoffman.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is a special edition of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions, questions that you can send to us via radio program at AOL.com. Joining me today is Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin. She is a registered dietitian, and she is also possessor of a master's degree in the field of nutrition. How you doing, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman, how are you?
Good, good. So summer is waning, but you know, it's been a good summer. It's been a relatively mild summer, not too brutal.
And, yes, that's true.
I tell you, this morning there was sort of a real freshness in the air. I stopped using the air conditioning. I opened the windows and put on my running shorts, took a run, and it's actually quite pleasant for the dog days of August.
It's a nice dry day, yeah.
Yeah, for the dog days.
It's a nice dry day, yeah.
So today we're going to answer your questions. And anything in the news in particular that you want to talk about today?
Anything in the news? Oh, not really. I'm doing the critique for the next newsletter about the low-fat beats the low-carb diet for burning fat.
Okay, yeah, we talked briefly about that.
In
our podcast, yeah. And some of you may recall. And so you're going to, it's kind of a clickbait, you know, I would call it, which is, you know, because after a while it's like low-fat diet, okay, that wasn't any good. So now it's the low-carb diet, everybody, it's all about low carbs. Now all of a sudden somebody comes up with a study saying that, no, it's not true. Low-carb dieting not as beneficial as low-fat dieting, and he sucked all of the air out of the room and got a whole lot of press around that. With a study that at best is questionable, and you're going to talk about it in our Hoffman Center newsletter, right?
I am. I'm going to take it apart.
Okay, great.
So, yeah.
Perfect.
Look forward to that, everybody.
Thanks for doing that. You know, it's like great because via the newsletter and via these podcasts, we sort of pre-masticate the news for you.
We have to, you know.
Yeah. It's like a mama bird and a little baby bird. You know, we have to kind of, because otherwise, you know, you choke on all the data, right?
Yeah, and it's become ever more important to me because headlines apparently are running the show in terms of the media, that we have to dispel a lot of these false headings about the intention behind them. We have to discuss all of that. We have to uncover what's going on here, and I'm going to do that as often as possible. Honestly.
Okay. So we're kind of like a watchdog kind of function here. Okay. And by the way, you know, we are. We call it as we see it, but, you know, if there's a study that critiques a vitamin or a supplement or, you know, some theory about diet that we've adhered to, we'll be happy to discuss it, you know, we're open-minded.
We have to be.
Yeah.
We wouldn't be good practitioners otherwise, Dr. Hoffman, would we?
Right. Recently, there's headlines about fish oil supplements. Fish oil supplements turn out to not be of any value, blah, blah, blah. And what it's based on is a study where, actually, it's an offshoot of what's called the ARID study. The ARID study is a study that looks at the eye and has looked previously at the effects of lutein and zeaxanthin and zinc and DHA from fish oil on slowing the progression toward macular degeneration, which is a very common problem, especially in Caucasian women. Caucasian women have a higher incidence than, African-American men and men in general. And so they did the study, and they found, and this is now established science, and ophthalmologists are aware of this, and they will sell you eye supplements based on this, mm-hmm. that you can actually slow the progression of macular degeneration. There's no medication that will do that for the dry form of macular degeneration. But out of that study, an offshoot of that study is they looked at whether the administration of fish oil could slow the progression of cognitive decline in older individuals, and they found that fish oil struck out. It did not slow the progression towards cognitive decline. Now, I have to see the study, but from my preliminary looking at the study, I think they gave one fish oil capsule to the patients over a period of 5 years, and they concluded on that basis that fish oil was not beneficial at slowing cognitive decline.
Just now, the one?
Yeah. Now, so, you know, and I think that that's sort of an example of, you know, the one-a-day theory.
Right.
And, you know, that if it's if you take a pill, it's like it'd be like a statin. You know, take one pill a day, it's got to do it. With vitamins and supplements, it may or may you may not hit that sweet spot with just one supplement a day.
There has to be a therapeutic dose.
Yeah.
Which is far away from the one a day, let alone the RDA. So,
right. So, you know, I mean, I'm open to that. Well, I think that's another study that we're going to put on a radar screen and maybe drill down on, take a little closer look at, because the headlines that have been generated by this are just really ridiculous. You got headlines that...
Unfortunate,
I'm just looking this up here. Let's see.
The Alliance for Natural Health, there was a wonderful headline in there that the New England Journal of Medicine is saying, yes, we should know what's GMO and what's not.
Yeah, and I've talked about that.
And I'm jumping up and down. Yeah, that's wonderful.
And they wrote, I was really pleased, and New England Journal wrote a very strong editorial saying, hey, we haven't done the proper safety evaluation of GMOs. They're very concerned about the fact that GMOs enable more spraying of pesticides on fields because the genetic modification allows plants to resist the effects of pesticides, and therefore the weeds are succumbed to the pesticides. But the corn,
pesticides,
the soy,
herbicides, there's more glyphosate, more Roundup being sprayed as a result.
Exactly, and they say that the effects and consequences of that have not yet been properly evaluated. The other thing in the news is that Germany, which, you know, would you say Germany is a backward country? You know, kind of like a backwater kind of place.
No.
Okay, so Germany joins Scotland in refusing GMO products, GMO seeds. They don't want to grow GMOs. And I'm not sure that they're going to ban the importation of GMO products, but, you know, they're you know, pretty sophisticated countries with important economies, and they're saying no to GMOs. And we are rushing headlong into GMOs. Not only that, but the DARC Act in Congress threatens to prevent the labeling of GMOs so that we don't even know what we're getting.
That's true. That's true. Well, the corporations have bought our politicians, and we all know that story. So,
indeed.
It's so unfortunate.
Get ready for a flurry of stories that say that fish oil has no value. It's just based on that study. I mean, let us say that indeed they're correct, that one fish oil pill taken over 5 years will not have an impact on your progression towards cognitive decline or Alzheimer's disease. That may or may not be the case. I'll have to look at the study. But think of all the other benefits of the fish oil. The fish oil in that particular study was dramatically effective for prevention of macular degeneration, maybe helpful for reduction in arthritis symptoms, maybe helpful for mood.
Cardiovascular health.
They didn't say anything about mood, and we know that there are mood effects. Recently,
will definitely be mood effects. DHA is critical.
Yeah.
For neurotransmitter firing and everything, sure.
So
that would even be part of an anxiety depression protocol.
Exactly.
DHA.
But perhaps at higher doses than one pill a day.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
So the story is here it is. Study questions benefits of fish oil supplements. Fish oil supplements do little to stop mental decline. Stop taking fish oil pills. Boy, they're really going. It's based on one study. It's all of a sudden like, okay, study.
Wait, did they say case closed? Stop taking fish oil.
Okay, but then here's actually a little more thoughtful piece from the Washington Post. Omega-3 is still good for the brain, but fish oil supplements just don't cut it. Well, I don't know. I don't think you can conclusively say
no, that you can't.
The fish oil supplements don't cut it. I think, however, one pill a day may not cut it based on,
exactly.
on this. Yeah. So we'll take a look at that story.
I would also like to know in that study, Dr. Hoffman, did they do any fatty acid testing before determining how much fish oil that one a day was going to suffice, as it obviously doesn't?
Right.
You know, these are critical to finding out how much is a therapeutic dose, and if that didn't happen, then the study's really not valid. You know?
Well, you know, there's sometimes these big studies, another problem with these studies is that they look at an aggregate effect over a large population, and some of these some people may be very insufficient in omega-3 in that population. Some people may already be replete with omega-3. They may be conscious of the benefits of omega-3. So taking an extra pill may or may not make a difference. Conversely, some people may be so low in omega-3 that taking one pill doesn't do the trick. So we'd have to look for subgroup effects. That's one of the nice things about statistics. Sometimes you can take a study which shows no benefit in 100,000 people, but you may discover that for 10,000 of those people, there were decisive benefits. It just didn't show up when the statistical analysis was done.
Yeah.
Anyway, so let us we'll do a little homework on that particular study and bring our conclusions to you. Let's take a look at some of the questions that we have this week.
Yeah, and I think you've got some this week, too.
All right, so you're putting it back to me. All right, this one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, good. Okay, no, I'll start.
Okay.
This one is interesting. It is about, it has to do with, this one's from from Paula. Can you tell me what you would recommend for protozoa that most likely has spread beyond the gut? All right. So,
oh, my.
No, so here, so this is a little bit of a weird question because I don't really know what the situation is here. Protozoa are, you know, a certain category of one-celled organisms that can cause infections. Okay. So there are gut forms of protozoans that are like Giardia or amoebas, you know, amoeba, Entamoeba histolytica, that are cause gastrointestinal problems. And then there are other protozoan infections that include things like pneumocystis pneumonia, which occurs in AIDS patients, also things like trypanosomiasis, which is an African illness, leishmaniasis, which actually is an illness that's a tropical illness, but because of the immigration to the United States, it's now spreading into Texas. Toxoplasmosis.
Toxoplasmosis sounds familiar.
Yeah, toxoplasma is a cat-born...
From cat feces.
It's the cat litter disease that we have to make sure pregnant women don't get, but also immunosuppressed people can develop brain abscesses with that. Anyway, so those are examples...
Wow.
By the way, those are examples of systemic infections. Systemic meaning that they're not just localized to the gastrointestinal tract. You can get leishmaniasis, which is, goes through your whole body. It's a terrible condition. Toxoplasmosis, which can affect the brain, other parts of the body. Pneumocystis, you know, affects usually the lungs, but can, I think, spread. Trypanosomiasis, you know, and so on. I mean, these are unusual, but serious diseases. So the question for Paula is, who said that her protozoa has likely spread beyond the gut? And I worry a little bit because there are sometimes holistic practitioners, and I don't know who made this diagnosis, who say, oh, you know, now your Giardia is in your system. On what basis? I'm not sure. It's actually fairly uncommon, very rare, for a gut protozoan to go systemic. It can happen. You can sometimes have amoebic abscesses in your liver from amoebiasis, but that's kind of, that rarely occurs in the United States. That's sort of a third world disease. You know, a case like that would probably end up like case of the month in a medical journal of someone who has a liver abscess from amoebas that spread out of the gut and got into the liver. So, you know, I don't know what to say. You know, I'm not going to recommend anything because I question the diagnosis. And I on a question like this, I would have to know, on what basis do you suspect that the protozoa has spread beyond the gut? On what basis do you even think you have parasites? Also, sometimes a common overdiagnosis that, I mean, look, parasites are both underdiagnosed because, you know, nobody bothers to check for them, and you can have parasites for years, and they can be a cause of gastrointestinal problems and malaise and weakness and fatigue, brain fog for years and years and years. And then, all you know, lo and behold, somebody comes to our office, and we say, oh, well, let's check you for parasites. You have a history that's compatible with that. You don't even have to be outside the United States to get parasites.
That's true.
You don't have to come from third world. So, but on the other hand, parasites sometimes are invoked by holistic practitioners who want to point blame at some esoteric cause of a disease. So I don't know what to say about this situation.
Would a simple fix be a round of antibiotics?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the most practical fix. I mean, if indeed you there's if look, if there's proof positive that you have protozoa that's that has spread beyond your gut and you have an amoebic abscess, you know, you need to take Flagyl, or you need to take powerful you know, anti-protozoan medications, sometimes combinations of medications.
Wow.
And, you know, that's in the realm of conventional medicine, but not, you know, not like an herbal thing.
Right, right. Well, anyway, thank you for that question, Paula.
Yeah, unusual question.
Yeah.
All right, now your turn.
My turn. We've got a question here from Jean. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, this week's Intelligent Medicine podcast with the herbal pharmacist was just the latest of many sources talking about the benefits of berries. My question is, do we just mean, you know, your blueberries and blackberries? The reason I'm asking is that botanically, tomatoes are berries. And according to Wikipedia, they even list eggplant and avocado and pumpkin as berries. Well, Gene, just to give just a definition of a berry is a fleshy fruit produced from a single flower containing one ovary. But I believe, although I didn't listen to that particular podcast, Dr. Hoffman, with an herbal pharmacist that maybe you interviewed, they likely just meant all the berries, meaning blueberries, blackberries, raspberries, strawberries.
Uh-huh.
For their phytonutrients.
Yeah, that's a little bit as if I, you know, did a feature on pet ownership, and someone would say, "Yeah, but what about, you know, Komodo dragons, and what about, you know, brown bears and rhinoceri?" I mean, look, botanically, that I mean, this is a sort of pointy-headed question because, indeed, botanically, entomologically.
Yeah.
You know, from a classificatory standpoint, you could call a pumpkin a berry, and that's kind of interesting and an esoteric fact. But what we're talking about are purple, red, and
colors. Yeah,
purple, red, blue berries that are rich in proanthocyanidins, and these are mostly, you know, blueberries, gooseberries, strawberries. Strawberries have a slightly different profile. But, you know, that's more what we're talking about.
Right, right. I mean, quinoa is a berry. Buckwheat is also a berry. I mean, there's all kinds of,
Okay, okay.
But, Gene, that's really what was meant, was the fruit,
right.
The berries, those particular. Thank you for your question. Okay, we've got a really...
But we have a very erudite audience. I mean...
I know.
It's like little-known facts that a pumpkin is a berry. Wow.
Pumpkin is a berry.
Yeah.
It's kind of big, but
An eggplant's a berry. An eggplant's a berry. Yeah.
Yeah. We've got a very, very thoughtful question here from Valerie. It's just the tiniest bit long, but it begs listening to. She says, this has been on my mind since April. When I listened to two Intelligent Medicine podcasts in a row, the second was an interview with Lise Altshuler. She mostly spoke about supplements that should or should not be used with chemotherapy. But at one point in the interview, she mentioned certain supplements that should not be used by people with cancer, regardless of chemo, namely B vitamins, because they can act as growth factors, and all forms of beta carotenes. The podcast just before Lise Altshuler was an interview with Mitch Gaynor. He said that everyone has dormant cancer cells, we rely on a strong immune system to keep them dormant. Here's what I hope you can comment on, Dr. Hoffman. If we all have dormant cancer cells, should we all stop using multivitamins that contain B vitamins and beta carotenes?
Okay. This is an interesting question. You know, it's, and she's setting it up by saying that, indeed, we did a very fascinating interview with Lise Altshuler. I have a lot of respect for her.
She's wonderful.
I think the premier naturopathic oncologist who is really does her homework on what supplements are good to take for cancer patients, and she also takes into account cancer survivors. And, you know, we've long had this belief that, you know, taking every vitamin under the sun, you know, may be good for some people, you know, take a multivitamin and just take lots of B vitamins and, you know, just take a bunch of stuff, probably is going to be helpful and probably not harmful for the vast majority of people. But when it comes to cancer, it may be that certain supplements may be utilized by the cancer to grow, to literally grow. Okay? So, now, to the second part of the... I'm sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
I just a comment about we all have dormant cancer cells. Yes, this is true. But when it's actually called a cancer is when our immune system has lost the fight and now there is a tumor or a metastasis present. Is that correct?
Correct.
That's when it could probably become problematic to take folate or something like that.
Okay, well, so let's go to the second part. The second part of the question is, so let's say, I mean, the first part of the question is applicable to if you're a cancer survivor, say you've had breast cancer, prostate cancer, you name it, and you're a survivor, you know, should you be taking certain vitamins? The question, then this, she extends that by saying, look, if the theory being that everyone has cancer events in their body at some time or another, might it not be prudent for people to follow the precautions that we use for cancer patients? I think that's the thrust of the question. And thereby, should we avoid certain vitamins? Now, Lise Altshuler does not say avoid all B vitamins. She targets a few as having the potential to make a cancer grow. One of them is potentially folic acid and even folate. However, this is very controversial because... there's actually studies that show that folate prevents cancer if you don't have cancer yet.
If you don't have cancer, right.
But if you actually have active cancer that's growing, it might promote it. It's a duality. So this makes it a little hard sometimes for us to choose. I think when she prepares her supplements, by the way, you can find her information about her products at integrativepro.com. Her products are the Pro Thrivers products for cancer survivors, and it's a very nice line. And she has different products like a multivitamin, but also something that helps chemo brain and something that helps sleep and something that helps energy, because these are problems that cancer patients have. And, she designed this because she deals with a lot of cancer patients. Okay. So, so it is her belief that certain supplements may act as growth factors for active cancer. I mostly agree with her, and actually I don't tend to use a lot of B vitamins in my cancer patients. I think B6 is generally safe and probably supports the immune system and doesn't promote cancer cell growth. But there's a possibility that other B vitamins might. So, for example, when I give intravenous vitamin C to cancer patients, it's a clear liquid. It doesn't have B vitamins, which have sort of a yellow or amber color. I don't add the B vitamins intravenously because I figure, you know, get some from food. You know, I think she's also concerned about the effects of manganese possibly on cancer patients. I think that's one of her concerns. But again, this ain't rocket science yet. You know, it's merely theoretical. We don't know precisely. The theory about certain vitamins is that cancers are primitive, and they don't have the ability to utilize antioxidants, for example, to protect themselves from radiation or chemotherapy, so that... generally, it's safe to give even antioxidants during times of radiation or chemo, which sometimes work via free radical mechanisms to kill cancer. So, you know, this is an area of controversy. And however, you know, I got to say that the weight of the evidence is that well-nourished people with a balanced portfolio of supplements have the ability to sustain good immunity and fend off cancer. And the net result is not that the
bottom
cancer
line, yeah.
grows, is that the patient's immune system is robust and can edit out mutations which cause cancer.
Right, right. And keep it all dormant, yes.
Right.
Thank you for that very, very thoughtful question, Valerie.
Indeed. And this is a good point at which to pause. We divide our podcast into two parts. So today we will continue on in part two with I'll give you a preview of what we're going to talk about in part two.
Uh-huh.
We've got an interesting question on Hi, Layla and Dr. Hoffman, can you briefly address the bioavailability of oral vitamin D3 supplementations versus vitamin D obtained from natural sunlight? Interesting question. We'll take that up in part two of today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We'll be right back.